Welcome to the Oxford Sidebar Podcast for Thursday, May the 16th, from the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association and the inaugural Pint of Science Festival 2013. Our speaker this month was Professor Charles Spence, who spoke to us about the body and the senses. Do you really know which body is yours? We hope you enjoy.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to our Sidebar tonight, which is also the last night of the Pint of Science Festival, which is the first annual Pint of Science Festival, and it happened in Oxford, Cambridge, and London this year, and next year it will hopefully be in lots more cities. So we've had a great week, and we're the Oxfordshire branch of the British Science Association, and we run our sidebars here at the pub once a month, and it's normally the third Thursday of the month. So we were quite excited when the organizers of the Pint of Science Festival asked us to take part, because we're strong believers in getting people to the pub to have a beer and listen to some great science. And it's my pleasure to introduce our final Pint of Science speaker, and that's Professor Charles Spence. And Charles is an experimental psychologist at the University of Oxford, and he runs the cross-modal research lab there. And if my understanding's correct, that's basically they're interested in how your brain deciphers all of the information coming from all of the senses into something sensible. And thank you.
Okay, so it's a pleasure to be here tonight and to tell you a bit about some of the things we've been doing in the lab on the corner of South Parks Road, possibly the most ugly building in Oxford, experimental psychology. Yeah, kind of looks like a ship, ocean-going line if you get it from the right position in the park, but from the inside, very ugly. And I'm a psychologist who works on the senses and how the senses interact and how what you see and hear and feel and touch and taste and smell and how when you feel pain, how all the senses come together and interact to affect your behavior in your brain. And we're very interested in how to apply those insights to the real world, be it in designing warning signals for car drivers, be it in designing packaging for beer or something else, through to helping various groups of patients with disorders of their body image, say. And tonight I want to tell you about the work we've been doing on touch, specifically, and the body, and the senses, and some of the kind of interesting stuff that we've come across. The lab in Oxford has psychologists, it has neuroscientists, it has marketers, it has perfume makers, chefs, we have one here tonight, artists, all mixture of sciences and disciplines, all interested in the senses and using brain science to apply it, in this case through touch. I'm going to tell you about some illusions, some experiments you can try at home, you can try on your friends, we'll try some on each other, and hopefully after I've finished, then Charles Michel, our chef, and Carlos will set up on those tables over there and allow you to try for yourself the rubber hand illusion and also the mirror illusion that we have here. So if those are fun, if you get to try them and you'd like to try some more experiments, then our Colombian chef here is at the very present time cooking up dishes of food in the lab in Oxford and paying people to eat his food. So he's got some slips, and maybe you might want to come along and try out some Franco-Colombian fusion food in a very particular style. There's a whole lot of psychology in there too. So I'll start with a couple of facts about touch and the skin. You've probably all heard the phrase, I know it like the back of my hand, which is used as kind of as a description, a way of saying, it's so familiar, you know, I just know it like nothing else. That's the most familiar object to me, the back of my hand. Turns out it's not. Wilhelmine and Richardson, 1982, did a study where they took a picture of people's hands, the back of the hand, and showed it on a picture with lots of other objects like coins and pens and other stuff, and just showed them to subjects and said, okay, here's 10 objects, just tell me what's the most familiar of these objects. And most people didn't recognize their own hand in the picture. They always picked something else as being far more familiar to them than the back of their own hand. One of the cases where kind of psychology normally tells, kind of proves the bleeding obvious to many people, but in this case, the bleeding obvious turned out to be wrong, and you don't know the back of your hand. A bit like when you have a coin or something, things that we've seen every day, and you ask people, which way is the Queen's head pointing?
Right.
To the right? Right? Maybe English people are smarter than Americans. If you do it with a dime, people have no idea whether it's pointing to the left or pointing to the right. I think it changes by the succeeding monarch points in the opposite direction, I believe. So it is to the right. But very often people don't know that. They've seen it so often, so familiar, they no longer have to remember quite which way it looks. The next thing, if you're thinking about touch and the skin and the body, normally it's vision that most psychologists and scientists are interested in. And then if they're thinking about any other sense, it's probably hearing. And touch comes a definite third in the ranking hierarchy of kind of psychologists and scientists' interest in the senses. And yet, it's probably the biggest sense. So the question for you is, what proportion of our body mass do you think is made up by the skin?
The most,
very good.
And, I'm a nurse, medical student.
But what percentage? What percentage of body mass is made up?
About 80-90%.
Of the skin?
Of the skin is the mass of the body.
No, just the skin itself would be
if you short it off though from there down.
quite a lot, I agree with that. 10%. Any higher?
20%.
Got it right. 18-21%, probably depending on your size, of body mass is given over to the skin. So in that terms, in terms of the mass of each sense, probably touch is the most important. It's the biggest, at least. And if we look inside the skin and think about what's going on in there. We kind of feel surfaces as uniform. They might feel hot or cold. There might be a pressure on our hand as something's heavy is put on there. We might feel the vibration of the phone in our pocket. Lots of different receptors in the skin for temperature, for pressure, for pain, for vibration, for sort of sudden touch. Lots of different receptors mixed there in the skin. And I think the skin does a really great job in terms of blending temperature and pressure and pain and vibration into one experience of a particular object held in the hand at the time. We don't just feel a temperature, or just feel a vibration, or just feel a pressure of something. We feel the whole object against the skin. And that's particularly good because, in fact, the receptors are kind of distributed quite widely across the skin surface. And you can try that yourself if you've got a ballpoint pen, and just drop it on your hand, or on your friend's hand, and think about what you feel. Specifically, think about the temperature that you get. And I'm feeling nothing, it's just kind of normal temperature. And there, it feels cold. It's always exactly the same pen top, but you move it across the finger, the hand, normal temperature. And at a certain point, maybe once every 5 or 10 times you drop the pen on your hand, it feels cold. And that's because you're directly on top of a temperature receptor that's picking up that coldness of the nib of the pen. And yet when you feel a cold object, like my beer here, I don't feel distinct points of coldness. I feel the whole object as cold. And our brain's doing a great job of integrating across different types of receptors in the skin, even when they're spread out quite far apart. Another thing you might notice if you're in pain sometimes, if you get a sudden sharp pain, you might, if you pay attention to your sensations, what you'll feel is two pains. A very sudden, quick pain, and then a few tens of milliseconds later, a slow, throbbing pain. And that's two different senses of pain related to the same sudden impact on the skin. And that difference in timing between first sharp pain and second throbbing pain, you can measure that, and that tells you that certain of the fibers going from your limbs, say, to your brain, are myelinated, are covered, others are uncovered, and one transmits signals through your body faster than the other. You can also try that yourselves if you don't want to hurt somebody or hurt yourself. If you just take your fingertips and rub them together and introspect, think about where do you feel the sensation. You can try it. And probably you feel your fingertips, nothing more. If you then take your right fingertip and rub it against your lip, and think about what do I feel being touched? Then you start feeling your lip, in a way. And you no longer feel your finger so much. Then take your fingertip and rub it against your ankle. It's still the same fingertip in all three cases, but now you should feel your fingertip and not your ankle. So here, exactly the same skin surface. Here, your two fingers hit the brain at the same time, so you feel both fingertips. Here, the signal from your lip to your brain gets there quicker than the signal from your finger that's going to go all the way down up here, 25 meters a second, and hence you feel a sensation in your lip And when I touch my ankle, it's further from my ankle to my brain than it is from my fingertip to my brain, and hence the fingertip wins. That was one Becker Sheik, kind of a Nobel Prize-winning physicist, physiologist, who demonstrated that in 1963. Of course, he's slightly biasing results, because not only is the lip closer to the brain, it's also more sensitive than the fingertip, which in turn is more sensitive than your ankle. So it's both a matter of timing there and of differences in sensitivity. Change your experience of touch depending on which surface gets to your brain faster. What else can I tell you? We have skin, and most psychology, most research goes on these bits here, on kind of the hairless skin of the hand. These are pretty sensitive organs. They can detect very tiny stuff. Really good. And no one's really thought about investigating the rest of the skin, the hairy skin, until it turned out somebody like Ian Waterman, who was a guy who had a very nasty viral infection when he was young, and he lost all sense of touch on his body. He lost all sense of where his body was, so that if he was standing up and you turned the lights off, he'd fall over. He just couldn't feel touch on his body. So this viral infection had knocked out all his sense of touch on the body, and yet, if somebody stroked his skin slowly, if he stroked the hairy skin slowly, at about 3 to 5 centimetres a second, the brain would fire. Ian Waterman couldn't tell he was being touched, but his brain was firing away, because this speed, 3 to 5 centimetres a second, is pleasant touch. And it turns out only 10 years ago, researchers found that there are special receptors only in the hairy skin, not here, and not on the soles of your feet, that like being stroked. And if you stroke at the right speed, then the pleasure circuits in the brain activate. If you're a big kind of shampoo manufacturer, you train your models for the TV adverts to do themselves at 3 to 5 centimetres a second, hoping that the audience at home will mirror that speed of touch and hence deliver pleasure to the brain of the consumer by seeing what they see on TV. And amazing, it's only been discovered for the last 10 years. And probably the idea is, why is it these pleasure receptors only on the hairy bits of the skin? Probably because they're important in grooming. And if you're kind of a monkey and you want other monkeys to pick out the nits from your hair, why should you bother doing it? Maybe you only do it if there's some sort of pleasure in the activity. And that's why, hypothesis why, there are more receptors, only receptors here, for this stroking 3 to 5 centimetres per second. Maybe that's involved in sort of massage type stuff. That's kind of could be at that sort of speed. It may explain why if you get some new bit of clothing, you go shopping, and you're thinking, do I want to buy that new pyjamas or whatever it might be? And sometimes people will pick things up and look at them like that, touch them like that. But other times, they'll kind of put them to their lips. And maybe the reason for that is, again, it's tapping into the hairy skin and say, how pleasurable does that feel? I can tell it here, but I can't tell it because I have no of these pleasure receptors on this bit of the skin. So it might explain some kind of observational studies about what people do when they go for a certain kind of clothes shopping. And it may also be that there are kind of individual differences here. So it's a really exciting area of research just opening up that suggests that maybe autistic individuals have a selective deficit in this kind of pleasant touch system. 3 or 4 papers just came out this year in a really active area that might explain some part of their condition. When we think about touch as psychologists, we think not only about the different receptors in the skin and how they're brought together, we also think who's doing the touching. And here we can separate out active touch, when I touch something and think about what it feels like, and passive touch, when the experimenter rubs something against my body. Does that feel the same or different? Am I more sensitive to active than passive touch? These are all experiments that are kind of very important in the lab. And also a kind of growing area. I mean, for my PhD, I spent all my time, a lot of my time, sandpaper. It's not very pleasant to touch, but all psychologists interested in touch use this. Why? Because I can go to the hardware store and buy 8 gradations from very rough to very soft sandpaper. Nice kind of a progression of roughnesses. Anyone can buy it, and then you can get people to rub surfaces and say, how rough does it feel? How much do you like it? And I've got videos of my subjects who've spent hours in the lab rubbing different bits of sandpaper, and you can sort of see the sort of their fingertips slowly being exfoliated onto the surface of the sandpaper. It's like, why did I spend so many years on this? Why did so many other psychologists spend so many years on this? Just because it's easy to measure, easy to get hold of. But really, this isn't the kind of touch I ever want to normally go around seeking out. Instead, it's other kinds of touch pleasurable touch, soft touch, interpersonal touch that's more important. And it's just in the last couple of years people are really starting to get. And so touch, we have these receptors. We have pleasure receptors. We have temperature. We have vibration. We have pressure in the skin. But those aren't really kind of the interesting kind of experiences we have through our skin. The pleasures are nice, but we're not aware of them necessarily, although our brain is. But really things that are more important are things like stickiness and wetness. Stickiness, if you're a Unilever selling something like a deodorant, say, then you're very interested in how can we reduce wetness underarm through our deodorant. And Unilever comes to a neuroscientist, a psychologist, and says, okay, we're interested in wetness. How do you detect it? And the answer is there is no receptor in the skin for wetness. Wetness, like stickiness, and many other of our more interesting sensations of the skin, is a touch blend, a combination of different kinds of receptor activity. And I could show you about stickiness. We've had some of my students doing undergraduate projects with jams of various consistencies, rubbing them between the fingers and trying to say, how sticky is that? It's much harder to get gradations of stickiness than it is gradations of sandpaper. But one of the other touch blends that's of interest is wetness. So if I take two gloves, medical gloves, or anything else you can think of, this kind of very thin to the touch, my hand cannot feel wet through this. It's an impermeable barrier. But here I've got two beakers of water, one cold and one hot. And if I stick my fingers in those two, the one on the left feels very wet, the one on the right doesn't. Why? Because the one on the left is cold, and coldness plus temperature is a touch blend that gives rise to wetness. If you don't believe me, you can try it yourself. So this is one interesting touch blend. Another one you can try is, here we've got two coins, exactly the same, 20 pence pieces. One was sitting underneath the hot beaker. The other one was sitting underneath the cold beaker. If I now put them on my head, the cold one feels heavier than the warm one. Why is that? It's another touch blend. The kind of pressure on the head is a combination of temperature and other cues. I won't let you have those. So the sense of touch that we have, the effortlessly integration of different receptor types into touch blends, things that are interesting, stickiness, wetness, pressure, and the like, that's really kind of exciting. And our brain's doing all that work without us ever being aware of it, that it's gluing together temperature, pressure, and so on. So that's the brain at its best, but the brain is sometimes pretty bad. And there are lots of illusions of the touch and the body that you can try out for yourselves. The earliest is probably from Aristotle, and there's the Aristotle illusion, for which you need to cross over your two fingers like so, and then find a kind of an angular surface, like the edge of this table, and then rub your fingers up and down along the edge. And if you get the angle just right, what you should feel, what Aristotle felt, was in fact two surfaces between the fingertips rather than just one. With the fingers like uncrossed, it just feels like a corner of a table. Cross my fingers and suddenly it starts to feel a bit more like two tables. You can sort of do it with your nose as well. So this is the oldest illusion, a confusion of touch elicited by crossing the fingers over in a way that we don't normally do. We don't normally do it, but Fabrizio Benedetti did it to his subjects in Italy for 6 months. People come into the lab and say, would you mind crossing your fingers, sir? Yes. Come up with gaffer tape and then leave the subject for 6 months. Some of the subjects dropped out. and after 6 months, this feels completely normal. And then when you unstrap the participant, this gives you the illusion instead. So our brain adapts to its normal posture, whatever that might be. Benedetti then he kind of disappears for a few months. A few years, and then he reappears 17 years later with a book not about the Aristotle illusion, but about pain and how to get rid of it. So I wonder whether there's some connection there between his subjects who are strapped like this. So this is the most common way that Aristotle first discovered the illusion of touch, and of two touches by crossing the fingers. But other bright sparks said, well, does it only occur to the fingertips? Can you do it with other parts of your anatomy? So you can try it with your ears. They're pretty flexible, and you can cross them over, and you can get the Aristotle illusion on your ear. Those of you who have the right kind of tongue can kind of, mine's not, but get your tongue and kind of turn it over, and you can get the Aristotle illusion on the tongue, apparently. And if you're one of Italy's most famous psychologist, Kanitsa, who made the Kanitsa figure, is an illusory figure, in a lesser-known and untranslated 1909 paper, he took his testicles, crossed them over, and you get the illusion there as well, should you want. So we clearly don't want to do that just now. But another kind of confusion of touch comes from this. This is the Japanese illusion. So if you get into pairs and cross your hands over like this, one of you in the pair, I should say, it won't work with two, and then bring your hands inside like this, and then the person next to you should point but not touch one of your fingers very quickly, and you've got to move the finger that's pointed. Okay, so this is what's known as the Japanese illusion, first written about 1898 by Henri in France. He doesn't say why it's called the Japanese illusion, and I've been unable in a decade to find out quite why it is called that way. If you're a musician, especially a pianist, you may have been familiar with this test. You find it in some music training manuals as a way of trying to, if you're playing two-handed piano, this is a good exercise to allow you kind of independent control of the fingers. And this seems to be like a confusion between left and right, Japanese illusion, studied for a century or so. If that one doesn't work on you, another way to confuse people is just to put the fingertips interleaved like that. And again, this works in pairs. And if one person puts their fingertips interleaved, have your fingertips, like say on the table here, and if you close your eyes, and I'm going to touch two of your fingers, and you've got to say, do you feel it going from left to right, or from right to left?
Right to left.
Okay. And that was still left to right again, and you reversed it. And so if I touch two fingers, if I touch a right finger that's to the left of a left finger, your brain reverses it. It's kind of the Aristotle illusion again, but in motion on the hand. So certain combinations of fingers you get right every time. Other combinations you systematically reverse. And with Max Zampini, we spent lots of hours playing with our participants on versions of this illusion. Another one that's a bit harder to do in person, but it's very important scientifically, is the crossed hands illusion. So all those things are about confusing your fingers by crossing into leaving the hands. If I get people now to put their hands in the lab crossed over, and then I touch one finger, one hand, and then the other, in very close succession, I ask people which hand was touched first. Like this, it's dead easy, left, right, cross the hands over, and suddenly people get very confused about which hand was touched first. This is known as a crossed hands illusion. Again, discovered 1898, but then forgotten about for a century, and then reappears in the literature about 2002 as an undergraduate project for one of our students. And what's interesting about this particular effect, the confusion again of left and right when the hands are crossed over in an unnatural posture, our brain just can't compute that, is that if I test somebody who has been blind from birth, they have no errors at all. They're perfect like this, they're perfect like that. If I find somebody who has been blind, who's sighted for the first 5 years of their life and then was blind for the next 45, and I test them at 50, they behave just like a sighted person. They haven't seen their hands for 45 years, but the person who's been blind for 45 is as confused as a sighted person with their hands crossed. So this suggests there's a critical period in the first year or two of life when our brain gets a representation of the body, what it feels like from the inside, and separately it gets a representation of what I see in front of me. And the seeing left and right hand and my internal left-right hand get confused, and that's why I get confused like this. And just a year or two of experience early in life is enough to set up that visual reference frame that stays with you for life. And so now psychologists are working with their clinicians in hospitals trying to find people who didn't see for the first year of their life and then regained vision through surgery at year one. Do they behave like a congenitally blind person or not? And then find people who saw for the first 6 months and then lost their vision to try and pinpoint exactly when is the critical period in development for this confusion effect. Now, the pianists, coming back to this illusion, the pianists who trained with this effect, they're very good at using the two hands and doing things differently, independently with the two hands. So you might think, well, maybe they're people who might not show this illusion. For you, if you show it, I can give you 100 trials, 1,000 trials, 10,000 trials, and you cannot learn. You cannot correct this for this error. But if I take musicians, from the Budapest Academy of Music, who've been playing piano for 18 years, and get them to cross their hands and to do so behind their back in a bit of space that you never see, a bit of space you never think about, then they too behave like the congenitally blind. So something about extreme practice of independent uses of the hands, together with putting the hands in a place you don't normally see, is enough to turn a sighted person into congenitally blind. And now we're looking also at autistic children again. And it turns out, in a study with my colleagues in Japan, autistic children do not show the crossing effect. They're just the same as congenitally blind individuals, and we're currently trying to figure out what's going on there. It's a very robust result. Autistic children are no worse like this. Sighted, age-matched, intelligence-matched children are completely all over the place like this. So something that the autistic is better at, perhaps, again, something to do with reference frames and perspective. And, of course, my brother, I don't have any children, but my brother has two, and when they were very young, he wouldn't let me in the room with them without an adult present. Because the natural question is to say, how early in development, if I get a little baby and kind of get the little kiddie paws across like that, and I touch one hand, which way will they look? That would be brilliant. So he wouldn't let me alone. But my colleague in London, Andy Bremner, did manage to get 5-month-olds and 8-month-olds into the lab, cross their hands over. You can vibrate one little little cotton glove, see which way they look. After about 3 times, they start crying. But enough data to map the initial trajectory of the crossed hands effect. So I say we're the cross-modal research lab, so we're interested in all the senses. And so far, I've just been telling you about touch, the different receptors in the skin, how they blend together, and how the brain gets confused when you cross left and right, your testicles, your fingers, your hands, whatever it might be. But of course, we're interested really in more than just touch. And we're really interested in all the senses and how they contribute to our body image, our sense of self, who we are, where we are, how big we feel, and so on. So I think actually all the senses contribute to our sense of self and our body image. And for this, kind of the classic example, it comes from this, a rubber hand. This used to squeeze shampoo bottles in Unilever headquarters in Port Sunlight. A rubber hand, this one here comes from the Oxford joke shop that used to be on the corner by the covered market a few years ago. This is pretty rare. It's a left-hand rubber hand, very hard to find. Right hands are much easier to find. It took years to get this. If you want hands of different skin colours, that's again very difficult, but we managed to solve that. And what happens, Carlos here is going to demonstrate for anyone who likes one of those tables over there after I've shut up, is you take a subject, you cover their hand up, you put the rubber hand in view, and then Carlos is going to come to the other side of the table and stroke the rubber hand and, out of sight, stroke the subject's hand. So what you feel is your own arm being stroked, but all you see is this rubber hand being stroked. That shouldn't be enough to trick your brain about where your body is. And yet, on average, 11 seconds of stroking is enough for you to start thinking, ooh, that feels like my hand. It's not your hand, it's just a joke shop plastic rubber hand. But 11 seconds of good stroking in time, and you're there. That is your hand. And I say, okay, yeah, it's just an illusion. And So I know you don't really believe it's true. So I want you to take your other hand under the table and point to where your real right hand is. And what you do is you point closer to the rubber hand than to your own one. So it's subjectively real. Your hand starts feeling rubbery and all sorts of strange stuff. And your brain thinks your arm is there and not here. And then if you're a bit vindictive, maybe Charles, you could do that. Once you say, oh, yeah, I'm getting it now. Yeah, that's really my hand. The experimenter comes on for your Vilnius Ramachandran. Like that. Better with a needle. And you'll start sweating. And you go, something like that. You've embodied in this artificial limb just a cheap joke shop rubber arm. You've had 30, 40, 50 years of experience of this thing, your own real arm, and yet vision completely changes where you think your body is and what it feels like. Amazing stuff. And now people all over the world are using this rubber hand illusion, rubber legs, rubber whole body illusions. It all works. What we see of our body is so powerful that normally when I see a hand in front of me, that is my hand. I don't need to think about what I feel. And maybe my sense of touch isn't so accurate. And vision dominates, rubber hand rules.
Size or skin colour affect it?
You can get the illusion. We've done it with Frankenstein's paw, bloodied and colleagues in London have done it with white skin colour with a black hand. Seems to be a bit weaker. It's just possible you can do it with a block of wood like that, if I stroke it just right. Parts of the illusion work, and Ramachandran claims he can do it on the tabletop. He's a magician. So it can work with, it breaks down a bit, and then you might ask if you're anorexic or bulimic, if you have a particular body image distortion, we could blow this hand up to make it bigger than your own hand, or make it smaller than your own hand and see whether the anorexic is more likely to take ownership of something that's smaller than themselves or bigger. I forget which way it goes, but it makes a difference. And the Italians are doing that. And not only that, what we've done here with Lorimer Moseley, who was an Australian physiotherapist, psychologist in the physiology department about 5 years ago, is we measured people's skin temperature when we were stroking the rubber hand. And it turns out as you start to embody this hand, you lose ownership of this hand, and your temperature drops. Selectively in this limb, not in this limb, not in your right leg. And the more you say, that's me, that rubber hand, the more your own temperature drops, the correlated temperature drop here and ownership of that. It's almost as if your brain is saying, that doesn't belong to me anymore, so let's just cut off the blood supply, save all our energy for the rest of my body that is really me. And we're going to come back to that, this temperature drop that you can elicit through a joke shop rubber hand, changing the temperature, kind of a sort of a physiological response just on one limb. The effect is small. Your hand might drop in temperature by half a degree at most, but it's measurable and it's limited to this hand. And we can stick you in the brain scanner and say, which parts of your brain own your body? And how does that change before you experience the illusion, after the change, experience the illusion? And we can localize different bits of the brain that are involved in maintenance of who you think you are, where you think you are, and bits that are involved in preserving that self-image. So that's vision, very important. What you can also do is hearing. So if you get people to rub their hands together, and I have a microphone, I can play the sounds back over headphones, and you hear shh, 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 shh. Then I've got a pedal under the floor. We did this at the Royal Society with 2,000 people a few years ago. You're rubbing your hands, I press my pedal, and suddenly the sound that you hear is no longer your own hands. I can make it louder or quieter. I can boost just certain frequencies and make your hands feel like shh, 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 or and as I do that, as I change the sound of your hands as you rub them, your hands start feeling moist and clammy or parched and dry and paper-like. Again, you should know better. You've had decades of experience of what these hands feel like, and yet if I change the sound, if I know how the brain works, I can change your skin perception from moist to dry. This is the parchment skin illusion as compared to the rubber hand illusion. And my colleague Cesare, who used to be a PhD student in Italy, there's lots of sculpture around there, marble. He's got the marble hand illusion now where he gets subjects and he taps their arm with an object. And you start off just hearing the sound of your own arm being tapped, and then each time he taps it, he changes the sound a bit. And so after a few seconds, what you hear is the sound of marble being tapped. And people get this illusion that their hands can't move, that their hands are cold, that their hands really feel like marble. And then again, he threatens the hand and you can see what happens. So our brain is using the sound of our body, what it feels like when we touch it, to infer what we're actually experiencing. And how you can use that yourselves, and this is kind of a trick that car panel beaters and furniture makers have known for a long time, is you, if you want to enhance your sense of touch, all you need is a piece of paper. So if I want to feel how rough, smooth this surface is, if I've kind of sanded it down, and I want a perfectly smooth car or something else, well, to touch, it feels pretty good. But if you put a piece of paper over your finger and rub the surface again, suddenly you can hear it. And those sounds are giving you information about how smooth or not that surface is. So this piece of paper is one of the cheapest ways to enhance your perception, sensitivity of touch, because it turns your finger into an amplifier and you can hear the sounds back instead. And that's been used intuitively from the car panel beaters, the furniture makers for decades, and now we have an understanding of why it is. It's about the sound and not, as people used to think, about masking a certain bit of touch. So vision is important. Sound is important to your sense of touch as well. What about the other things, senses? What about smell? Smell, you'd think, isn't important, really, in what my body feels like. But it is. If I give you a bit of fabric like this, this is from one of our experiments with Unilever. It's on a wheel rotating. You have to feel this bit of fabric and tell me how soft or rough it feels, whether it's been coated with a fabric conditioner or not. And if I squirt a smell up your nose at the time, at the moment you're feeling this bit of fabric, I can make it feel soft or rougher. If I squirt the smell of Greek goat, as best as we can describe it from my PhD student, it'll feel rougher and harder. If I squirt into your nose the smell of perhaps some fabric conditioner or other smells, pleasant smells, this will feel significantly softer to the touch. You think you're just feeling between your fingertips, your brain's taking in the smell, and we've done this on the street in Oxford with about 100 consumers. Add a drop of fragrance, the right fragrance here, this will feel softer. Not only that, if you're a Givaudan making perfumes for shampoos, they've done the experiment with hair. That if you get people, you can buy hair swatches from Eastern Europe of all different frizzinesses, put them on a wheel, get people to feel this hair swatch and say how soft or frizzy or shiny does that hair feel. Change the smell, you change the touch, what you feel. So that's about the importance of smell to what we feel. What about for ourselves? It's also true that the Lynx effect does really work. That if I get young ladies, bring them to the lab, show them pictures of Brad Pitt versus somebody really ugly, lots and lots of pictures of men, and get the female subjects to rate the attractiveness of the men, if I add the right fragrance, Lynx deodorant, those faces will be rated as more attractive. The body looks more beautiful with the right smell than, again, with Greek goat or synthetic body odor we have, or burnt rubber, are all really bad for your attractiveness ratings. So that's women rating men. But of course, women are also worried themselves about wrinkles, about how they appear, what their body looks like. And there, too, smell plays a role. So you might often see in the adverts on TV and elsewhere, 8 out of 10 women said this skin cream make their skin look less wrinkles. The wrinkles just disappeared, at least temporarily. A lot of those claims are based... The claim is true, but not for the reasons that you think. It's nothing about the active ingredients in the skin cream that actually remove wrinkles. That may be impossible. But the skin cream contains a fragrance. If I add a relaxing fragrance to the skin cream, you put it on your face, the relaxing fragrance makes you relax, and as you relax, the wrinkles disappear. Beautiful. So I've supported the claim, and a lot of those things you see on TV about wrinkle removal are, again, about the smell of your body rather than what it feels like. So all the senses play a role in touch perception. Just a couple of more things I want to tell you about. One is about individual differences that I think are really interesting but not really studied much. So one I like, again, you can try, if I ask you to write a letter E on your forehead now, just so you did yours with the pointy bits going out that way, and you did yours with the pointy bits going out the other way. So that question, write an E on your forehead, it's kind of ambiguous, because if I write an E now on your head, you might see it, feel it, as if you're me, and I'm writing E, but if you, the centre of your body, the eye, is, I always think I'm looking out from inside my body at the world, you might see that letter reversed, because you're looking out from inside your head, and you feel an E kind of back to front. You can try this with P's and D's, P's and Q's, B's and D's, ambiguous pairs of letters. And some people will write them as if they're looking from the inside out. Other people will write them as if somebody out there is looking at their own body. If I do it on the front of your head, I'll get people to write on their stomach. Half people go one way, half go the other. If you write something on the back of your head, everybody sees that letter as if they're standing behind their body looking forward. So this says maybe we have our sense of perspective where we are within our bodies varies a little bit between individuals and between which parts of the body we are writing on. And the interesting part of this is from Galinsky. It kind of turns into a social psychology of the body experiment. If you came into Galinsky's lab in the States, he would say, okay, imagine a time when you were really powerful, when you were in control of whatever it was, whatever it is you're doing. Now write a letter on your forehead. And if you've been primed with powerful images of self-control and self-importance, you will always write as if you're the inside looking out at the world. If I prime you and say, no, I want you to think about a time when you were really humiliated and there was an authority figure, you know, kind of doing bad things to you, after primed that way, you'll write the letter as if the person out there was looking at the head, the opposite orientation. So simply by sort of priming powerful or powerless changes the perspective we have on our own body from the internal to the external. And finally, I want to talk about how this research can be used. And I think there are a number of ways. We work with art galleries, with museums, on touch, thinking about how to make art museums accessible for the blind. Can we make tactile artifacts, replicas of real objects in the museum that the blind person can go and feel? And if they can feel it, will that be like the real thing of a sighted person seeing the artifact in the museum, or will it miss some stuff? So lots of really important questions there about how you translate art for the blind. What attributes of an artifact do you need to copy? The weight, the temperature, the texture, the material, the size, in order to give the blind the right kind of experiences. We work also, as you can see here, with companies making tactile packaging. So this is kind of a deodorant stick where we've changed the feel of one end of the deodorant stick versus the other. This is my can of Heineken. It's done a very nice job. Most cans are just smooth. This one has tactile indentations on it that are asymmetrically laid over the packaging that I think make you pick up this can in a certain kind of way. Well, there's another example of use of touch, not in the museum, but in the marketplace. Sensitive, soft touch Dove deodorant, and it's got a certain sort of sheen and feel on the packaging. And maybe this is my favourite one, and I don't know if it's been designed by the scientist or just intuitively designed. It comes from the south of France. So it's a skin moisturiser. And if you pick this up, it feels kind of rough and it feels like bad design. It doesn't feel soft and nice. But as soon as you try the product and then pick up the bottle again, suddenly it feels completely smooth and all that roughness has gone away. So here you can use touch to create certain impressions, to change the way people interact with a product, and we're very interested in that. We're also finally interested in sort of helping people with image disorders of body image. We don't really work with anorexics, but we do work a lot with chronic regional pain syndrome patients. And these are people who've had a motorbike accident most normally. They've come off their motorbike, they've been knocked off, and one of their limbs is kind of pretty badly mangled. It seems to recover. And then about 6 months after the accident, after they think they've recovered, an intense, extreme pain develops in the affected limb. And this limb starts to swell up a bit. And this pain is chronic. It will not go away. If you come up to one of these patients and someone's going to touch your hand, they'll kind of withdraw. They have chronic, horrible pain that medication won't treat, that surgery won't treat. So what can be done? These patients, when clinicians go in the hospital and say, are they really a chronic regional pain syndrome patient, or are they just pretending to be one, for whatever reason that might be, the clinician will come to the bedside and pick up the patient's two hands, and if one hand is significantly colder than the other, that is the bedside test that they really are suffering from this condition. These patients, their affected limb is about 2 degrees colder than the unaffected limb. With our rubber hand, we got a half a degree of cooling. With chronic pain patients, you get about a 2 degree of cooling effect. So chronic pain for these patients, suffering really badly. Medicine, surgery does not help. Will psychology help? And we've been doing work with Lorimer Moseley in physiology to say, if I take a pair of binoculars and I turn them back to front, and you look through a pair of inverted binoculars, your hand looks really small and far away. If your hand looks small and far away, will the pain hurt less than if your hand looks really big, if you magnify it through a magnifying lens or the normal way you see binoculars? So we get the patients. They're very hard to bring into the lab, very hard to keep in the lab for the experiment. We can get some, about 10. They're looking at their affected limb. It looks really small, and we get them to make certain kind of gestures with their affected limb. And just by using this visual illusion, making the painful hand look smaller, their pain ratings go down significantly. And not only that, once again, this visual trickery, the visual illusion, makes the swelling of their fingers literally go down slightly but significantly. So once again, just like the rubber hand, the inverted mirror the inverted binoculars can be used to reduce pain, swelling, a real physiological response on people. We've only done it in a very short-term way, and currently in Australia we're testing over the long term to see whether this will give long-term benefit for these patients who cannot otherwise be helped. And these patients have a cold limb. If they put their limb across the midline, it gets warmer. If they put their unaffected limb on their bad side, it gets colder. So these patients have a cold side of space, and the magnitude of the temperature drop in their affected limb predicts the severity of their symptoms. And finally, I'll just mention some individual differences. So far I've treated you as if we're all the same, but we're not. I said autistics might have problems with the affective touch, but I think there are lots of really interesting things here in the sense of touch and the body. This is my laser pointer. The battery doesn't work at the moment. But if you've got one, come across one, just try shining it on... Oh, it is working. That's good. Let's stick your hand out. Can you feel anything?
I don't think so.
I don't think so. Try it. No. Try that one. So far, it's okay. Can you feel any warmth?
Sometimes, yeah. It pops around.
Pops around with a sort of sense of warmth.
Warm in some places, not others.
Okay. So people... when you shine the laser pointer on people's hands, a third of people, one out of three, will experience... Perfect. It's like it wasn't going to work, but it does. A third of people will experience warmth in their hand. That if you closed your eyes, it would disappear. So it's an illusory sense of warmth that a third of people experience, again, driven by vision. If this pointer was blue, you probably wouldn't get it. It only works with red laser pointers, but a third of people will get it. That's one kind of individual difference. We don't understand where it comes from or why it exists. Another kind of individual difference we've never done the experiment on, but I really want to, comes from things like this. There are certain materials that you like to touch. There are certain materials, and if you're like me, I hate to touch. Sends a shiver down my spine to think about touching them. This is my kind of least preferred material, Oasis. Some people don't mind touching it. Others like me find it completely, it's just something really, really unpleasant about it. It's not dangerous to this touch, but it's really nasty to the touch to me. Just others, things I really hate the feel of are kind of the inside of these cardboard boxes, or my fake peaches that again have kind of a, to me, not to other people, a really horrible feel to them that's not dangerous. Some people like, some people don't like. And that's a great unanswered question. But what is it, the individual differences that differ between us in the things that we like to touch and the things that we don't? Is it something about our early childhood experiences? Is it more fundamental genetic differences? Who knows? And maybe it might link to the final bit of touch and the individual differences. So when you think about touch, we always think about the outside. If you read any book on the psychology of touch, it's all about touch on the outside. One of the most important bits of touch is touch on the inside, in the mouth, telling you about the texture, the swallowability of foods. And that's a world of touch that we differ in hugely. Some of you will have 16 times as many receptors on your tongue as other people. That difference we can test with one of these strips. So this strip, some people will not taste anything. Others will taste something unpleasant. And you sort of stick it on the on your tongue and let the saliva waffle around. What do you get?
Ever so slightly unpleasant.
Nothing? Slightly unpleasant. And for me, it's really disgustingly bitter.
Oh, no.
Now you're getting slowly. Still slight. But you're not kind of pulling your face like a... so this is a test for bitter taste, prop or PTC. A quarter of people can taste nothing. A quarter of people have to spit this thing out and say, when will the taste go away? And a half people say, yeah, it's kind of unpleasant, kind of a bit like sprinkled aspirin, but I could leave it there or not. So that taste test tells you about how many receptors you have in your tongue. Those who are super tasters to this will be better able to discriminate alphabet spaghetti on their tongue, pick apart the individual letters. More touch receptors, better enhanced sense of touch, living in different taste worlds, but also different touch worlds. And finally, if you're a super taster, then it's likely that if you put an ice cube on your tongue and think about the taste that you get, some people will experience sweetness from an ice cube. And it depends where you put it on the tongue. Then I get sweetness at the sides, bitterness somewhere else. Well, I'll leave it at the front, and anyone who dares later. So again, this is an individual difference in the sense of touch and taste, illustrated with the ice cube, if not with a bit of tasting strip. So I think there's lots of exciting stuff to be done there to really take apart this kind of, we're all the same in the world of touch. We all get confused by some stuff. We all blend certain other things to think in what ways are the worlds of touch that we live in completely different and why, and what kind of evolutionary reason is behind that. And if you know these individual differences in touch, how can you then put them back into product packaging or something else? And finally, if you're feeling that you're not feeling enough, put on one of those. Just a few minutes of blindfolding is sufficient to increase the sensitivity of your fingertip to touch. 30 minutes plus, and you'll start feeling much more through the fingertip. So that's a very easy way to improve your touch. Either with a piece of paper to improve your roughness perception, or this to improve your sensitivity, both will work. So I shall leave it there. Very happy to answer any questions. I think Charles, Michelle, and Carlos will be very happy to try and demonstrate the mirror illusion or the rubber hand illusion on one of those tables as we break.
Thank you. That was pretty interesting. I was wondering, with the individual differences you talked about, are there any that concern gender that you know about, or examples where gender differences will really make an impact on the effect?
Not much. We don't specifically look for gender differences in any of the senses, but they do pop up sometimes. And when they pop up, it's primarily around smell. So I bet if I'm scenting bits of fabric, women will be more likely to show enhanced softness perception through smell than men. Specifically, purely in the sense of touch, there are differences, slight differences in the distribution of receptors and sensitivity for men and women, but nothing that very big that we've seen. Apart from, women sometimes like having their toes sucked more than men. Think of Fergie's. And there's a story about that I'll tell you.
Related to that point, do you think there might be cultural biases in that as well? That you might be conditioned to like certain scents?
Certain
scents or textures or something. And that's not really anything to do with your genetics, but it's something that's socially constructed. I don't know. I was just wondering how you might be able to think that.
I mean, so it's only cultural differences in sort of interpersonal space and how close or far people are happy to be or feel uncomfortable. In terms of actual the things that people like to feel, I haven't come across anything. But those who probably know would be the car manufacturers. So Peugeot has a whole division on the feel of fabrics for the interior of the cars. So if they're selling cars worldwide, they'd be the people who have probably the most interest in that. But I haven't seen anything published, but maybe it's so interesting they'd keep it for themselves.
How many senses are there? I had a conversation with someone the other day that told me there were more than five.
The idea of catching a ball is, how do you know that it's here or behind you? Are there five senses, or is that something that's under you?
At least five. Quite how many, no one can agree. So it's like a really philosophical question about how many there are and how do you know. I could tell you people who... So New Scientist had an article running a couple of years ago that said there are up to 43 different senses. So touch, no, temperature, no. Yeah, touch, vision, hearing, taste, smell. Then pain, is that a separate sense from touch or not? Might be your sixth. Pheromonal sense, kind of the sense of a sort of social communication without conscious awareness, might be a seventh one, but maybe it's kind of smell. Then you go, some people talk about sense of time, I'm not sure about that. What else have we got?
Motion and acceleration.
Can we sort of proprioception and where your body is? And what else have we got? So back in 1980, researchers at Manchester University psychology department took a load of people in a minibus, blindfolded them, drove them around lots of roundabouts, and then let them out of the minibus and said, which way is north? And they were significantly better than you'd think. They weren't perfect by any means, but which led to the suggestion there might be a magnetic sense, very weak in some people. No one seems to have followed it up since then. And then the question becomes, like in the world of touch, is touch just one sense? Or if I can show there's a receptor for temperature, and there's one for vibration, and there's a separate one for pleasure, are those three senses, or is it just one sense? And if it's three senses, I've got, that's kind of nice for me, because I've got more experiments I can do. But maybe that's not the way to, the right way to think. So there are books coming out all the time on how many, and you could justify. I mean, when I asked my lab last time, a year or so ago, how many senses do you think we have? I've got answers between about 5 and 13. And I say it could be up to 43.
Yeah, I was reading an article I was reading about a study that was done a while ago that suggested that there were people that were taken and they were having brain surgery, and they had open brain surgery, and so they were able to stimulate the brain directly, and so they during the surgery they did a test where they would stimulate this person's hand and record the measurement of the brain with the electrical impulse that was a response to that, and then they could do the same thing and stimulate the brain directly and measure the electrical response to that. And then when they expected there to be a gap between the finger and the brain as the message traveled, what they found is that the response time was much, much less. But then when they stimulated the brain directly, it kind of introduced its own gap into the response. And that seems pretty profound in itself. I was wondering if it seems valid to you. And also whether or not they kind of suggested that it might have been beyond the physical limitation of how fast the transmission.
So I think a version of that experiment that we've tried, I think the general claim is true that maybe your brain's doing some work to put things in the right order and make predictions about the world, is that if I touch your toe and I touch your lip, I can calculate from nerve conduction velocities how much later your toe should reach your brain than your lip does. That's any order, 20 centimetres, and that's a metre and a half. So then I can do a test to say, OK, how much later does it feel to you that your toe reached your brain with some psychological test? And it turns out when you do that, it doesn't feel as late as it should do. So your brain is kind of compensating for, it knows that it takes longer to get from your toe to your brain, and hence it partially realigns things and kind of adds a delay to things that are near your brain to compensate for the fact that things that are further away take longer. And then hopefully you get a more veridical view of things moving across your skin surface. Because if you imagine a little creepy crawly going one way in your skin, you'd want to know whether it's going towards your head or away. And to do that properly, you need to be able to then calculate and kind of correct for these differences in timing. And probably all our senses are doing that to some degree. Well, you know, with thunder and lightning, we kind of hear the difference between what we see and what we hear. But for things that are closer to us, they still arrive at our brain at different times. We should perceive them as asynchronous, as not matching. And yet our brain glues them together kind of effortlessly. And there's a lot of that going on.
Why does a kick in the balls hurt that much?
I know what you mean. Yeah. But we struggle to get ethics for that kind of stuff.
It hurts more than anywhere else. So there's got to be some
reason behind it. As you say, you know, there are bits of your body like your sort of back flanks that are not very sensitive, but there's a reason for that. There's no particular reason to protect those bits and other parts of your anatomy that do play a more important role in finding food or sort of foraging or fornicating. You should be careful about.
Is there a rock, paper, scissors in terms of senses? Does one compete out the other?
So normally it's what you see dominates most of the stuff, and most of the experiments are done showing that. But not always. So probably each sense does dominate for something. And then when you're asking about when did something happen, then what you hear dominates when you experience stuff. And when how fast did it change? Hearing dominates for that. Kind of smell will dominate for off flavours in food. If I gave you a beautiful meal that smelt rank, you wouldn't touch it no matter how beautiful it looked. So there, smell can dominate too. And then probably taste dominates for, if I want to know the real nutritional value of a food, I can only really tell it from the tongue, sweetness or calories or something. And then for touch, what's it good for? It may be this kind of affiliative and emotional touch. It's something that, you know, researchers didn't even think about when they were doing all the sandpaper research, but for the last decade, suddenly, there's a whole explosion of emotional touch, and maybe that can deliver more profound benefits and well-being than stimulation of any other sense. And if I had more space in my rucksack, I could have brought my vibrating chair, which I have in my lab in Oxford, just like a plug-in from the Sharper Image in the States for your car drivers. You plug it in, and it sort of vibrates you, and put that on in my lab when somebody's sitting on it, and people just smile. I've never had anybody sitting on the chair, turn on the vibrator, and they don't smile. So I think that's something there about deep pleasantness about the sense of touch. So I'd go probably for that.
I don't know if this is me confusing senses, so possibly pain and touch. But people who lose limbs, who then experience a sort of phantom pain in that limb. So with some of your touch sort of interventions, there's a way that's quite easy now to stop people feeling that.
So it's kind of similar in a way to these chronic regional pain syndrome patients who still have the limb and it hurts a lot, awful lot. The phantom limb patients have had their limb amputated and it hurts an awful lot, even though it's not there. And if you are Mr. Ramachandran, he'll say, this is the cheap way. Again, surgery doesn't work, medicine doesn't work, but this mirror, any of us can buy and it works. And you put it in a box. And then you have the good limb looking in the mirror, and the patient imagines their other limb, even though they have none. And you get this mirror illusion that it looks like you have another limb, and that feedback will reduce pain. He tells us it works, but we would argue in that case we're not sure that it does. So something works about having this mirror box, whether it's the visual impression of seeing a limb that's gone, or whether it's just making you think about sort of motor imagery. That's a bit of a technical point, but... So there are ways of reducing the pain. It does help with the mirror box, but it might not be due to the mirror itself. But yeah, I would see that as kind of analogous in a way to the chronic pain patients.
If we don't have any more questions, maybe I'll ask you to join me in formally thanking Charles for an amazing talk and the final Pint of Science Festival talk. Thank you very much. Thank you.
So, just had a fantastic sidebar talk by Professor Charles Spence, a really interesting, lots of demonstrations. And so, one of the things I was wondering about when you were talking was about prosthetics, because you're talking about sense of ownership of hands. And I really think that one of the big challenges of prosthetics is, particularly with hands, a sense of touch, and also for the owner to actually feel like it's their arm. I mean, I just was wondering if you had some thoughts on that.
Yeah. So we're working a bit on things like sort of telerobotics and telesurgery, where you have, say, for example, a surgeon in one country who's operating on a patient in a different country over the internet, and how you get the person in one place to kind of embody, take ownership of the limb or the surgical tools in another location. And I think hopefully the idea is that lots of the insights from things like even the rubber hand illusion, if I can trick you into thinking a rubber hand is your own, kind of use any of the insights there in order to help figure out how to do sort of telerobotics to make people embodied in a foreign location, be them a surgeon, be they an engineer, or operating all kinds of devices. Just with the rubber hand, if I can do it there, then I could, hopefully we can help others to embody. And that becomes really important, say, how do you, that sort of sense of ownership, how do you do it? And I was just in Barcelona with colleagues there who were doing lots of embodiment work. In that case, with kind of headsets that made you feel, so they made me feel like I was a little girl, and Mummy came in, she was really aggressive. So they're working a lot on embodiment there and how to, and so this virtual environment, how can I make you feel like you're a little small child and know what it feels like to be a parent of a certain kind of abusive or aggressive? And so lots of applications, I think, of if you can embody people through technology, it's becoming increasingly easy.
And I think touch, I was reading again with the things like with embodiment touch is important for just, I guess, controlling. If you know where your limbs are and whose they are, it's quite important. So, for instance, that somebody, if you don't know where your hand is, trying to pick something up is very hard because you're not getting the feedback and you're not getting the grip and so forth.
Or even something like, so in Germany I was there recently, and they got a 20 million euro simulator for car drivers. That can fly you around in three dimensions. But somehow the drivers, when they went to this 20 million euro device, weren't feeling like they were really driving. And it turned out just having a little cheap fan, like one of those kind of battery-operated fans that blows wind in your face, if you put that on in front of subjects as they're driving around in the 20 million euro thing, this 2 euro plastic fan does the job of really making people feeling like they're there. But when they accelerate, they feel this wind on the face, and that just stimulating the sense of touch in a very cheap way was what they needed to kind of to enhance sense of presence and embodiment.
So it's not really a high-tech thing. I'm looking at the mirror box and the console. It's amazingly how easy you can do it with.
In some cases, yes. The mirror box is a great example, and the laser pen and this cheap fan. So it can be very easy. On the other hand, it can be incredibly hard as well. If I say I want to give you a glove so that you could imagine, I think Disney Corporation are doing lots of stuff at the moment. I'm trying to get you to wear something so that they can make you feel as if you're really holding a teacup or a teapot or whatever it might be. And they've got some amazing technology, they say, that can do that. But for me, in the lab in Oxford, all I can afford is a mirror, a cheap fan. And just if I wanted to create a... I mean, it's much easier in a way to create sort of virtual reality visually. All I need is a headset. But to stimulate the skin, well, my skin's kind of always moving as I move my limbs, so it becomes really hard to actually deliver a hyper-realistic full-body sensation.
So you can do it for parts, but... Yeah, because I think I've seen them working... I'm sure I've seen something about a game where they're trying to get people to... I think it's the game where they're trying to get people to feel as if they're actually in the... in the gaming environment.
Yep.
So, yeah, that is...
Yep. And so maybe our approach would be to say, okay, it's going to be primarily visual if it's a gaming event, but how much extra realism or presence can you get just by vibrating the gamer's seat or by releasing the smell of the dungeon? That might have far more impact than, you know, millions of dollars of extra sort of technology to make the visual resolution better. That would make people more feel as if they're there. But just the occasional sense of touch, the occasional smell... could be enough just to really enhance the presence.
And I was wondering, with this smell, you were talking about the fabric conditioner and the softness of the fragrance. I mean, is there, because I mean, smell can be quite potent for memory and emotions and so forth. I mean, there's also a culture. I was wondering if, do people with that one, is there, they associate it with fabric conditioner, or does it feel softer because they associate it with fabric conditioner, or because of the kind of fragrance?
So probably, I think... the view is that all of our responses to smells are learnt. So you see a little baby and they'll like things that adults will find offensive to smell, but kids like poo-poo and all sorts of stuff. That so we learn all our responses. And things we like them because they're associated with good times, with calories, with alcohol, with sugar, with caffeine, whatever it might be in foods. And so in that case, why is it that certain fragrances work to make things feel softer? It might be that we've just learnt through prior experience. Or it might also be that... So now we're working with two or three perfume makers in London. And when those perfume makers talk about the perfumes they make and all the different smells they have in their cabinets, they talk about in terms of colour. This smell smells dark. This smell smells sharp. This smell smells round or soft. And I wonder there, maybe there's some deeper association between the senses, that maybe there are just certain smells that are more gradual in their onset. Another smell that just hit you, like vinegar, just very sharp. So I imagine one of those kind of more gradual onset smells might be the ones that will make you feel things as softer, because the smell is in some sense rounded or less sharp, even though you might not have actually paired the two things before. But certainly in lots of cases, if I take those fabric conditioner smells, aren't intrinsically soft, but we've all had the experience of wearing clothes that felt softer because they smelt soft. And then, in a way, you're right, we're just playing it back to people, saying, okay, now just tell me about the touch, and I change the smell, and miraculously it feels. Remember, the main point, though, is to say we always think we're just seeing what we look like in the mirror. We always think that we're just feeling what's between our fingertips, and yet all the other senses are always sending messages to our brain, and whatever the other senses are telling us can impact the experience of something as simple as softness, something as simple as how white is that fabric after it comes out of the washing machine. You think that's just a purely physics question about vision and refraction. If I change the smell, certain things will look whiter. So all the senses come together, no matter what we think we're judging.
Great, thank you. And I guess, sort of finally, a more general question is that what, and this might be a really huge one, is just what do you think are the next immediate, perhaps the immediate next steps? What would you really be interested in doing in the next few years? What's the many questions?
For us, what is most exciting at the moment is kind of food and drink. So it's still multi-sensory, it's involving all the senses, and maybe food and drink is something we all do two or three times a day, eat and drink, and it's probably some of life's most pleasurable experiences. And if I take the taste of a plate of food, I can smell it, I can taste it, I can hear it, it's got a temperature, all the senses are involved. And so now I think there's a really great opportunity to work with chefs, and we had one tonight, Charles Michel from Colombia. A lot of the young chefs are really interested, they've seen the Heston Blumenthal's, the Ferran Adrias, and they're really interested in kind of learning about science, learning about psychology and neuroscience and how the brain works, and saying, okay, if I know that, how can I design things differently? And what's really exciting there for us is that all our funding comes from big companies, from the Unilevers, Procter & Gamble's, Kraft, Nestle's and the like. And there you can have some insight, but it's very difficult to actually implement change, because you say, I've got this great new insight about how the brain works, let's put it on the shelf, and they say, no, I'm going to speak to my manager, the manager's manager, and then there's a downsizing, a resizing, and it's lost. Whereas if you can get a chef, he's got the restaurant or a bar, and you can convince them tomorrow, it'll be on the menu, and there'll be people coming in and experiencing these sensory innovations. And what happens there, we hope, with in Heston's restaurant or with Charles Michel, or what happens there in those fancy restaurants a year or two late down the line will be in every restaurant or bar, or the best things. So that's really exciting. The chefs and the cocktail makers, they've got the creativity to say, that's a nice bit of insight, that's a nice kind of scientific insight. How can I make that into something that's really tasty? And that's really a great area, and that we're doing a lot of work at the moment, and kind of very excited that the chef's here at the moment. We're doing experiments in the lab, you know, as we speak, giving people food in different presentations.
Because there's some, I've seen there's some about music as well, isn't there? That different types of music may enhance what the taste of something, or depress the taste of something.
And again, so doing lots of work on sort of matching. Again, this kind of surprising matching of sounds to tastes. That high pitch and pianos are sounds are more likely matched to sweet tastes, and low pitch and brass sounds most people think go with bitter tastes. And taking that insight that could have been stuck within a big organisation. To the House of Wolf restaurant in London, and they, together with an artist chef, made a kind of a sonic cake pop where you could dial up at the table the sweet soundtrack or the bitter soundtrack, and we've got the research from the lab to show that if you listen to one or the other soundtrack, the food will actually taste different as a result. That's one example just where the science comes out in a way that's kind of fun, that people are paying for, and then we can measure it in the real world and say, do people like it, does it work, does it not, and if not, how do we change it to make sure it does work.
Thank you very much, Charles. It was really interesting and a fantastically interesting talk. So thank you again for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. We hope you enjoyed it. Details of our upcoming events can be found at our website, www.oxfordsidebar.com. You can also follow us on Twitter @OxfordSidebar and on Facebook, British Science Association, Oxfordshire Branch.